Good evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting arts radio station.
Arts.
I am Nicholas Miller here with my co-host, Steve Cato. Why don't you say hi to the good folks, Steve Cato.
Hey there, how are you, folks? I'm Steve Cato.
That's right. Steve's feeling pretty high and mighty in this episode because after our last show, he got to hop in the Hummer with Arnie, and Arnie put a cigar in his mouth, Steve was rolling around Chinatown with none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger in a big-ass Hummer.
It was
Ain't
huge.
That right, Steve?
Yeah, that's right. I did that. It's a thing I did. You know, you only live once, right?
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't Levon Lambeth jump in the Hummer too? He had a huge bottle of Polish liquor.
Yeah.
And he jumped in there too. Wasn't that right?
He was in there too. Yeah. That was called like Zombrowska Grimvaldskaya. I don't really remember.
Yeah. Well, it would have been nice if you'd invited me, but
sorry.
I guess someone always has to be on the sidelines. Otherwise, there'd be no sidelines. It'd just be this giant, beautiful oneness without sidelines.
That's right.
Isn't that right?
That's right. I mean, it's a good point you raise. It's almost a Percian fact of semic reality that you raise, actually. In order for the sort of monad to be perceived, there has to be a figure of two-ness within a Percian system observing the oneness. And then the position of thirdness actually is occupied by our audience who are observing that relationship in order to remark upon it as an object. Thus, all three are necessary to create any kind of meaning or any kind of semic whole, so to speak. So far as what you're saying about hanging out with Arnie and Levon and maybe you not feeling involved, just think about what an important job you were in fact doing.
Okay, well, enough talk of that. Tonight we have something very special in store for you. There'll be no drama. I'm just going to get straight to it. We have the vocal talent of Nick Sullivan, who will be reading J.R., which is a novel almost entirely comprised of dialogue. And what Nick's going to be doing for us, which is unprecedented on The Talking Show, is changing the character of his voice to evoke the feeling of different characters in the novel. Here we have it, Nick Sullivan.
Money? In a voice that rustled. Paper, yes. And we'd never seen it. Paper money. We never saw paper money till we came east. It looked so strange the first time we saw it. Lifeless. You couldn't believe it was worth a thing. Not after Father jingling his change. Those were silver dollars. And silver halves, yes, and quarters, Julia. The ones from his pupils. I can hear him now.
Sunlight, pocketed in a cloud, spilled suddenly broken across the floor through the leaves of the trees outside.
Coming up the veranda, how he jingled when he walked. He'd have his pupils rest the quarters that they brought him on the backs of their hands when they did their scales. He charged 50 cents a lesson, you see, Mr.
Cohen, without the H. Now, if both you ladies...
Why, it's just like that story about Father's dying wish to have his bust sunk in Vancouver Harbor, and his ashes sprinkled on the water there, about James and Thomas out in the rowboat, and both of them hitting at the bust with their oars, because it was hollow and wouldn't go down, and the storm coming up while they were out there, blowing his ashes back into their beards.
There was never a bust of Father Anne, and I don't recall his ever being in Australia.
That's just what I mean about stories getting started.
Well, it can't help repeating them before a perfect stranger.
I'd hardly call Mr. Cohen a stranger, Julia. He knows more about our business than we do ourselves.
Ladies, please, I haven't come out here simply to dig into your intimate affairs, but since your brother died intestate, certain matters will have to be dealt with, which otherwise might never come up at all. Now, to return to this question of... I'm sure we have nothing to hide. Lots of brothers don't get on, after all. And do come and sit down, Mr. Cohen. You might as well tell him the whole story, Julia. Well, Father was just 16 years old. As I say, Ira Cobb owed him some money. It was for work that Father had done, probably repairing some farm machinery. Father was always good with his hands. And then this problem came up over money. Instead of paying Father, Ira gave him an old violin, and he took it down to the barn to try to learn to play it. Well, his father heard it and went right down and broke the violin over Father's head. We were a Quaker family, after all, where you just didn't do things that didn't pay. Of course, Miss Bast, it's all quite commendable. Now, returning to this question of property... That's what we're discussing, if you'll be a little patient. Why, Uncle Dick, Father's older brother, had walked all the way back to Indiana, every step of the way from the Andersonville prison. And after that business of the violin, Father left home and went to teaching school. The one thing he'd wanted all his life was to own as far as he could see in any direction. I hope we've cleared things up for you now. We might, if he came back here and sat down. He won't find anything gazing out the window. I had hoped, said Mr. Cohen, from the far end of the room where he appeared to steady himself against the window frame. I expected Mrs. Angel to be with us here today, he went on in a tone as drained of hope as the gaze he had turned out through evergreen foundation planting just gone sunless with stifling the prospect of roses run riot, only to be strangled by the honeysuckle which had long since overwhelmed the grape arbor at the back, where another building was being silently devoured by rhododendron before his eyes. Mrs. Angel? The daughter of the decedent. Oh, that's Stella's married name, isn't it? You remember, Julia, Father used to say... Why, Stella called earlier. You told me yourself, Anne, to say she was taking a later train. That name was changed from Engels somewhere along the way. I'm afraid I'll miss her, then. I have to be in court. I scarcely see the need for that, Mr. Cohen. If Stella's husband is so impatient, he's hiring lawyers and running to court. You're losing a button here, Mr. Cohen. Thomas had the same trouble when he got stout. He couldn't keep a crease in anything either. Miss Bast, I'm afraid I haven't made myself clear. My court appearance today has nothing whatsoever to do with this matter. There is no reason for any of this to ever come into court. In fact, believe me, Miss Bast, both of you ladies, the last thing I would wish would be to see you ladies in court. Now, you must understand that I am not here simply as Mr. Angel's attorney. I am here as counsel for General Roll. You remember back when Thomas started it, Julia, and we thought it was a military friend he'd made? Of course it was James who had friends in the military. Yes, he'd run off to war, you know, Mr. Cohen, a drummer boy in the Spanish War. The Spanish War? He murmured vaguely, braced against the back of the Queen Anne chair before the empty hearth. Yes, he was only a child. But the Spanish War? That was 37, wasn't it? Or 38? Oh, not so long ago as that. I think you mean 97 or 98, was it, Anne, when they sank the Maine? Who? That's one I never heard. Do you feel unwell, Mr. Cohen? Yes, Thomas ran off right after James did, but he was too small for the war, of course. He joined a Tom show passing through town, playing clarinet in the entr'acte, and they also let him look after the dogs, finding livery stables to put them up in. You might have noticed his scar, Mr. Cohen, where one of the bloodhounds tore open his thumb. He carried it with him right into the grave,
But you're not leaving us so soon, Mr. Cohen. Of course, if we've answered all your questions, I know you must be a busy man.
Mr. Cohen might like a nice glass of cold water. No, it isn't water that I need. If you ladies, just for a moment, if you'll give me your undivided attention.
We have no objection at all, Mr. Cohen. We're telling you everything we can think of.
Yes, but some of it is not precisely relevant.
If you'll simply tell us what it is you want to know instead of wandering around the room here waving your arms, we want to see this settled as much as anyone.
Yes. Thank you, Miss Bast. Precisely. Now, as we are all aware, the bulk of your brother's estate consists of his controlling share in the General Roll Corporation.
Share? I think Thomas had at least 40 shares. Or 45, was it, Anne? Because we have...
Precisely, Miss Bast. Since its founding, General Roll has been a closely held company owned by members of your family, under the guidance of the decedent, and more recently that of his son-in-law, Mr. Angel. General Roll has prospered substantially.
You certainly wouldn't know it from the dividends, Mr. Cohen. There simply have not been any.
Precisely. This is one of the difficulties we face now. Since your brother, and more recently his son-in-law, have wished to build the company larger rather than simply extract profits from it, its net worth has grown considerably, and with that growth, of course, have come certain obligations which the company right now is being hard-pressed to satisfy. Since no buy-sell arrangement had been made with the decedent prior to his death, no cross-purchase plan providing life insurance on each of the principals, or an entity plan that would have allowed the company itself to buy up his interests, in the absence of any such arrangements as these, the money which will be required to pay the very substantial death taxes...
Julia, I'm sure Mr. Cohen only is complicating things unnecessarily.
Crowned by the complications inherent in any situation in which the decedent dies intestate.
Julia, can't you...
Further complicated by certain unresolved and somewhat delicate aspects of the family situation, which I have come out here today to discuss with...
Mr. Cohen, please, do sit down and come to the point. Yes, after all, Julia, you remember. Charlotte died without leaving a will... And Father simply sat down and parceled things out. Of course, I think that James always felt...
Yes, James made it quite clear how he felt. Do sit down here, Mr. Cohen, and stop waving that piece of paper around.
It's simply the waiver I mentioned, he said, giving it up and seating himself in the Queen Anne chair, whose arm came off in his hand. Julia, I thought Edward had fixed that.
It was the side door latch he fixed, Anne.
It didn't work when I let Mr. Cohen in. He had to come round by the back.
I thought you came in at the side, Mr. Cohen.
Well, I let him in, Julia, after all.
I thought Edward had
let him in?
No, fixed the latch.
Mr. Cohen, finished fitting the arm of the chair back into place, leaned carefully away from it.
"That is the waiver I brought out for your nephew Edward to sign," he said, resting his elbows on the scarcely more firm support of his knees.
"A mere formality in this case.
Of course, where there's a will..."
"There's a way. You're quite witty today, Mr. Cohen, but believe me, Anne, I think this is Thomas's will, the tangle things are in right now."
"Yes, just look at these obituaries. And why Mr. Cohen ever brought them out, unless to tangle things up still further? To read them, it's hard even knowing who's dead. Did you see this one? It's all about James.
James, and no mention of Thomas at all."
"I simply included it because," he began in a tone that seemed to echo the deep, as he fixed the newspaper streamer flown before his glazed eyes. "Word comes into a newspaper of a death. If someone there is in a hurry and just hears the last name, he might grab the obituary that's already written on someone like your brother James, as prominent as your brother James. They keep one written and up to date against the day."
"But James isn't dead. He's just away."
"Abroad, accepting some sort of award."
"Yes, yes, in fact, I think, if you'll read that clipping..."
That seems to be about all James does now, going about to accept awards. It's not as though he didn't deserve them, Julia. Don't give Mr. Cohen the wrong idea. There's no telling the stories he'll carry back with him. Ladies, I assure you, all I wish to carry back is this waiver with your nephew's signature. Since your brothers were not, especially close, and the decedent died intestate, the cooperation of the survivors is... You make us sound like a shipwreck, Mr. Cohen. Well, now that you speak of it, Miss Bast... I think I know what he's trying to say. He's going to drag up those old stories about James and Thomas not getting on. I don't think he could sit there and name two brothers who went out of their way for one another as often as James and Thomas did. Neither of them had a single job that the other didn't claim to have got for him. The Russian Symphony... And Sousa's band. Of course, there was a certain competitive spirit between the boys. No one denies that, Mr. Cohen. We had a family orchestra, you know, and they practiced 3 and 4 hours a day. Every week, Father gave a dime to the one who showed the most improvement. From the time they were 6 until they left home... Yes, Julia played the... Where are you going now, Mr. Cohen? If you'll just sit still for a minute, I'm sure we can find some black thread. I can sew that button back on while we're chatting.
While I wait to talk with your nephew, Edward. Whatever that paper is you've brought there, I don't think he'll be in any hurry to sign it.
Yes, I remember Father telling us to never sign anything we didn't read carefully.
But... Ladies, I want him to read it. I urge him to read it. I urge you to read it. It's only a few lines, the merest formality, a waiver to permit the appointment of the decedent's daughter, one Stella, Mrs. Angel, as administrator of her father's estate, so that we may submit to the court.
Mr. Cohen, you distinctly said that you hoped to keep us all out of court. Didn't you hear him say that, Anne? Yes, I certainly did, and I'm not at all sure what James will say about these goings-on. James has a great instinct for justice, Mr. Cohen, and in spite of his being a composer, he knows more than a little about the law. If we're all obliged to end up in court in order to settle what's right and wrong here...
Madam, Miss Bast, please, I implore you, there is no such issue at stake, and there is no reason there ever should be. The law, Miss Bast. Let me tell you, the law...
Do be careful of that lamp, Mr. Cohen.
There's no question of justice or right and wrong. The law seeks order, Miss Bast. Order.
Now, Mr. Cohen, if you'll just sit still, I've found some black thread right here in the basket.
And an agreement within a legal framework is made for the protection of all concerned. Now...
Perhaps you would like to take off your jacket. I'm just afraid you will spill those papers.
Yes, thank you. No. Now,
it's carpet thread and should hold quite well. It will probably outlast the suit itself.
Let me assure you that signing this waiver will not in any way affect any claim your nephew may have upon the estate of the decedent. But because of his somewhat equivocal position...
I got it for Father's overcoat buttons. It always outlasted the coats themselves.
I don't know what you're inferring, Mr. Cohen, but this is, as I understand it, Miss Bast, your nephew Edward's position in the family. His mother, who was known as Nellie... She wasn't simply known as Nellie. That was Nellie's Christian name, even though a lot of people thought it was a nickname. But I see no reason to start prying.
I think when James is done his memoirs—can you raise your arm a little, Mr. Cohen—a lot of prying people will have surprises. And after all the gossip that followed—
Ladies, I am not here to pry, but in the legal disposition of your brother's estate, his relationship to Nellie and your nephew Edward is extremely pertinent. Now, as I understand it, your brother Thomas had one child, Stella, by his first wife, who then died.
I wouldn't really say who then died, Mr. Cohen. Why, she was still alive when...
Of course, forgive me. At any rate, Thomas remarried one Nellie,
who in due course appears to have separated from him in order to cohab, to... Yes, to marry James, precisely. But I would hardly say in due course, Mr. Cohen. I think we were all really quite surprised. I don't know, Anne. Nellie was flighty. I remember James using that word, now that you say it. It was when Rachmaninoff was visiting. I remember because he'd just had his fingers insured. Hand me those scissors, please, Mr. Cohen. However, yes, thank you, here. Now, however, in the absence of any record of legally contracted marriage between the said Nellie and James, my dear Mr. Cohen, or indeed any evidence of legal and binding divorce between the aforesaid Nellie and the decedent, it scarcely seems necessary. And although it appears to have been known that this Nellie aforesaid was the living as the wife of the decedent's brother James, at the time she bore her son Edward, and had been so living for some indefinite time prior to that event, nonetheless, in the continued absence of a birth certificate attesting to those circumstances of his, provenance, Edward is in a position to exert a substantial claim upon the estate in question, and therefore... I scarcely understand a word you've said, Mr. Cohen, and where you got that piece of paper you're reading from. But I wrote it, Miss Bast. It's... His glasses are rather like the ones that James lost that summer up near Tannersville, aren't they, Julia? And the idea of digging up all this gossip again, why, Edward's been perfectly happy here, and James has been a fine father to him. There's never been any question at all why... But I don't question that, Miss Bast. The point is simply that in regards to your brother's estate, until his position is clearly established, he... What?
Just a little thread here, still hanging, if you'll hold still.
Yes, thank you again for the button, Miss Bast, but...
Are you leaving so soon?
No, I simply hope, I think, maybe... Maybe think better on my feet.
He's spilling those papers there, Julia.
Miss Bast, and... Yes, thank you, Miss Bast. And therefore, after Nellie died, Mr. Cohen, to the contrary notwithstanding, James brought him here then, you know, and we've practically brought him up ourselves. James's work has always made such demands. That's his studio there at the back. You can see it right out that side window, and we'd often miss him for days at a time. But the point, Miss Bast, the point of law at issue here is...
Julia, I think I heard something. It sounded like hammering, someone hammering.
The presumption, you see, the presumption of legitimacy, while not conclusive and rebuttable in the first instance, remains one of the strongest presumptions known to the law, and will not fail, Miss Bast. Yes, where is it? Hubert versus Cloutier. It will not fail unless common sense and reason are outraged by a holding that it abides.
There's no question that at the time, Julia, we all thought James's behavior outrageous.
In general, this presumption is not even overcome by evidence of the wife's adultery, in regard to your nephew's claim, even when this adultery is established, as of about the commencement of the usual period of gestation, as held in Basel versus the Ford Motor Company. Mr. Cohen, please, Edward has nothing against the Ford Motor Company or anyone else. Now, I am merely stating the legal position open to him, Miss Bast, in the event he should elect to pursue.
Hammering? Didn't you hear it?
Possibly your testimony and that of your brother James regarding the period of his cohabitation with the said Nellie prior to Edward's birth, since there is merely a prima facie presumption that, just a moment here, yes, that a child born in wedlock is legitimate, where husband and wife had separated and the period of gestation required in order that the husband may be the father, while a possible one is exceptionally long and contrary to the usual course of nature. You see? Now,
in bringing a proceeding to establish the right to the property of a deceased person, the burden is on the claimant to show his kinship with the decedent, where kinship is an issue, of course. As in this instance of basing a claim on the alleged fact, that claimant is decedent's child, and... Yes, that while in the first instance, where it is, yes, proof of filiation, from which a presumption of legitimacy arises, will sustain the burden, and will establish the status of legitimacy and heirship if no evidence tending to show illegitimacy is introduced, the burden to establish legitimacy does not shift, and claimant must establish his legitimacy where direct evidence, as well as evidence of potent... Is this word potent? Potent, yes. Potent circumstances tending to disprove his claim of heirship is introduced. Now, regarding competent evidence to prove filiation, Mr. Cohen, I assure you there is no need to go on like this. If, ladies, I have no choice in settling an estate of these proportions and this complexity, it is my duty to make every point which may bear upon your nephew's legal rights absolutely crystal clear to you and to him. Now, it's kind of him, Julia, but I must say, you understand that to proceed without taking into consideration your nephew's possible rights in this estate would be to jeopardize the status of everyone concerned, since to hold a child a bastard is not permissible unless there is no judicial escape from that conclusion. Mr. Cohen! And it is incumbent upon the party, assuming the fact of illegitimacy, to disprove every reasonable possibility to the contrary, and as apparently obtains here. In the case of a child conceived or born in wedlock, it must be shown that the husband of the mother could not possibly have been the father of the child. Crystal clear indeed, Mr. Cohen! Crystal clear. And while I am aware that you ladies may find certain legal terms somewhat obscure, nonetheless, in pursuing other evidence tending to support illegitimacy, a declaration of the deceased mother, for example, might be admissible, or any similar characterizations of family relationships tending, as part of a series of res gestae, to throw light, Nellie was never one to write letters. Or photographs, he came on in a flourish of papers at the wall behind him, for the purpose of comparing the physical characteristics of the child with those of the husband and such other man. Just behind your left shoulder, Mr. Cohen, that's always been my favorite picture of James. There, the two men sitting in the tree. The other one was Maurice Ravel. It shows James's profile off so nicely, though he always felt that our Indian blood... I don't think that's anything to get into now, Anne. It's quite all right, ladies. I have it here somewhere. Really, Anne? Yes, here, even where territorial statute provides for the legitimacy of the issue of marriages null in law, the issue of a white man and Indian woman has been held illegitimate. It is Cherokee blood, you understand, Mr. Cohen. They were the only tribe to have their own alphabet. Notwithstanding that the alleged marriage may have been conducted in accordance with the customs of the Indians on an Indian reservation within the territory, and that, I think, should settle that. It's not an area to meddle in, Miss Bast. He might like to see that picture of Charlotte in the headdress when she was touring with... Now, there appears to be another sister somewhere, Carlotta. That's precisely who Anne is talking about. She's right behind you there, Mr. Cohen. She what? Who? Do be careful, you're going to break something. She's there. Just above the building with the dome. That's one of James's Masonic lodges. Charlotte's wearing a green felt hat, but of course the color doesn't show in the picture. She bought it to get married in. She did this place over, you know, Mr. Cohen, after her stroke, which was why she left the stage. She made quite a name on the Keith circuit, where she introduced—what was that song, Julia? I know the sheet music is around somewhere, probably over in James's studio. She's wearing a hat made to look like a daisy. That was why she took the name Carlotta, of course.
And she died of the stroke?
Why, certainly not. She carried right on, with a beaded bag on her withered arm, and except for a slight limp when she was tired, you'd never know what she had gone through. She spent most of her winters in Cairo.
Cairo? That would be Egypt? Perhaps.
The tremor seemed to pass through his voice right out his arm, snagged in midair upon his wristwatch.
When I've talked with your nephew Edward, will he be down?
If Mr. Cohen would just come to the point here, we might not need to bother Edward at all.
Yes, Mr. Cohen, if you'll just tell us how we can work things out for him.
Work things out for him? He's not an infant, is he?
Infant? He's bigger than you are, Mr. Cohen, and you scarcely need shout.
Taller, Julia, but I wouldn't say bigger. I just took in the waist on those gray trousers.
By infant, I meant merely an infant in law, someone under the age of 21.
Edward? Let me think, Julia. Nellie died the year that James finished his opera, and...
No, she died the year he started it, Anne. Or rather, he started it the year she died. And so that would make...
His opera, Philoctetes. Maybe you know it, Mr. Cohen?
There's no way he could, Anne. It's never performed.
Well, there was the winter when James was in Zurich. Perhaps Mr. Cohen has...
Oh, dropped his glasses.
I hope they didn't break. That's a good way to take off weight, Mr. Cohen, bending up and down from the floor like that. I met the woman who told me about it in the ladies' room at A&S's. She was doing it with a deck of cards. She threw the whole deck out on the floor and then stooped to pick them up one by one. I'm sure some of the weight goes in perspiration, but perhaps Mr. Cohen...
Mr. Cohen seems to perspire quite freely.
If we're patient with him a little bit longer, I think that all he really is after is Edward to sign this piece of paper.
You have nothing else up your sleeve, Mr. Cohen?
I thank you for your patience. Yes, all I need is a copy of his birth certificate.
There, you see, Anne?
To establish his parenthood and his age. I assumed he had passed his majority, and fervently hope so that I won't have to deal, to inconvenience you ladies further. The validity of his signature, you see, of course, on this waiver, depending upon his legal capacity to contract, although, of course, a minor may be emancipated.
Emancipated, I assure you, Mr. Cohen,
which entitles him to keep his own earnings, but
every penny that Edward earns
in no way enlarges his capacity to contract, as in Masis Vernon Manon, I mean Mason versus Wright, yes, the contracts of an infant being voidable by him but not void, though this may not apply to necessaries, these, however, being relative. Now, comparing the voidable contract, which is in itself not void, to that of a lunatic, when, of course, his contract is made before he has been judicially declared incompetent, you ladies deserve...
Oh, Julia! Poor Edward!
You see, you ladies deserve every protection, because the infant himself is the only one who can take advantage of infancy. The defense of infancy is not available to the adult. And this infant may disaffirm any time he likes. His mere intention to disaffirm is sufficient. In an action brought against him by creditors, assignees, by purchase or in bankruptcy, sureties, or anyone else with a collateral interest in the contract, the mere setting up of infancy as a defense is sufficient, and none of them has available the defense of the infant, which is that of infancy.
As far as his age goes, Edward himself...
For your own protection, ladies, this birth certificate, because this infant, ladies, this infant may disaffirm any time he wishes to, even if he has misrepresented his age in the first place in order to get the other party to contract with him, remember that, ladies. Remember Danziger versus the Ironclad Realty Company.
I think he's going for a glass of water, Julia.
That door, Mr. Cohen.
Failing any adoption papers, which could, of course, change the picture substantially, since the adopted child has the same legal rights as the blood child, therefore, if the child were the natural child of the decedent's brother, but had been adopted by the decedent, he would, of course, have every right to participate in this estate. If, on the other hand, he...
He's going to get into Reuben, Julia. James never really adopted Reuben.
In the distribution of this estate, that is to say, since in order to satisfy taxes, part of this estate will have to be sold...
They're after our trees right now. I suppose it does look like an estate to them, Julia, stuck in their tiny pasteboard houses on little shirt-tails of land.
Forcing your holdings to go public,
they take for granted everything's for sale.
Proper evaluation will have to be made, of course, in terms of the prevailing market.
That's what the water people said when they went into court and swore up and down that back in our trees was the only place they could possibly put up their pumping station.
Since no part of the estate involved has ever been offered publicly before...
I heard hammering out there last night, Julia. I thought I heard the sound of a truck myself, or a tractor, the kind they knock down trees with. Would they do that, even the water people, come in knocking down our trees at night? They were there this morning. The water people? Why didn't you call me? No, the trees, Anne, the trees. I'm glad you saw them. I didn't really look. I can't say I did either, but I know that passing the kitchen window I would have missed them if they'd been gone. Perhaps Mr. Cohen looked when he came in. The oaks, Mr. Cohen? And some locust. It's the oaks, though, Anne, that really stand out.
Before the advent of such a sale, you would, of course, receive adequate notice.
What Mr. Cohen considers adequate... I can't even read them without a glass, Anne. Have you seen the latest one? I had it here just a moment ago. It's right there on the mantel, a picture of a castle. James's hand has never been easy, Mr. Cohen, and he tries to get so much on one postcard. Anne, I'm talking about the local paper. Mr. Cohen means these legal notices they tuck off in the back in type so small that no one can read it. In language no one can understand. In fact, if he has a moment now, he might be willing to translate something. But, Julia, he's just broken his glasses. Here it is, yes. Yes, this second column here, Mr. Cohen. No, right down here. It looks to me like they're up to something with the old Lempholm. Do they have a picture of it there? It was always the grandest house in town. And when we were just girls, Mr. Cohen...
This is simply a legal notice, Anne. They don't print pictures in a legal notice.
Can you see through the breakage, Mr. Cohen? It's a shame that Mr. Cohen can't see it. A white Victorian with a tower and a porte cochere along one side, and those copper beeches on the lawn. When Julia and I were girls, Mr. Cohen, we used to imagine living there. We dreamt that some great stroke of fortune would...
So far as I can make out here, Miss Bast, this is simply a petition for a zoning change to turn the place into a nursing home.
Old Mrs. Lemp never was well, of course, was she? It's her son we mentioned earlier, Mr. Cohen, the attorney you should be taking all this up with. But, Julia, someone should warn Mr. Cohen when he says the law has no interest in justice.
Ladies, please... I seem to be having difficulty making myself clear, but I assure you...
He made himself quite clear, didn't he, Julia? But I think he should be forewarned. If Mr. Lemp took no interest in justice, Father would never have chosen him.
Even James holds him in high regard, and James can be most critical.
Yes, and Tom, Julia, after all, he had Mr. Lemp begin the suit against that dreadful little man who started that musical instrument company and stole every idea Thomas had.
They're not instruments at all, Mr. Cohen. The Jubilee Musical Instrument Company is what he calls it, but all they make are machines that play tunes.
And that lawsuit, Anne, I think it was really James's idea. He was someone James held in great contempt. He had something to do with that awful family, that politician out west somewhere, whose family owned stock in the little company Thomas took on. There may even be some there in the drawer, when he was looking for sheep's intestines to... We needn't go into that right now, Anne, if Mr. Cohen has no more questions. But, ladies, this newspaper here, I understood it was the local paper. Well, of course it is. It comes every week. It's the only way we keep up with things. But it's... I just noticed it's from a town in Indiana. I'm afraid when you said local, I thought... Your attorney, Mr. Lemp, is in Indiana? Did you think he would be in Timbuktu? No, I simply meant that if... that a nearby lawyer who might be more familiar with local situations... He's quite familiar with them, thank you, Mr. Cohen. I wrote him last week about this bingo parlor, Anne. But I meant, to go back to your nephew, ladies, some clue possibly regarding his age, just on your income taxes, for instance. Do you recall listing him as a deduction? You talk about adequate notice, Mr. Cohen. This went up right under our noses. The holy name of something or other they play there every Wednesday night and park their cars right up in our hedge. I see, yes. Because if he is, that would indicate he is still a minor, though I trust he's not disabled. We'd better be thankful to still have the hedge. It deadens the noise from the road, James says. You might tell Mr. Cohen about those two women who came pounding on the door last week. Staring in through these living-room windows, they thought it would make a nice teen center. I see, yes. You see, your nephew, ladies, your nephew Edward, in the event he is still a minor, he... Looking in from the road, they said it looked empty. Just what were they doing looking in from the road? To protect his interests as well as your own, recalling Ignatchik versus Rowland, where the infant sought to recover his car and disaffirm the repair contract, the infant lost out in this case, ladies. The defense of infancy in this case, ladies, in this case, the court refused to permit it, using infancy as a sword instead of a shield. There, I heard something. Don't I hear him now? Your nephew coming downstairs at last? Edward?
Hammering, Julia. Yes, it couldn't be Edward. He left long ago, didn't he, Anne? I think I heard him leave when I was sewing that button on. He has class today, you know, Mr. Cohen, at the Jewish temple rehearsing Wagner.
He's left? You mean while I've been waiting, you just let him go? I don't understand.
We don't interfere with his comings and goings, but don't think we haven't wondered ourselves why he wants to teach at the Jewish temple. And what's got into them doing Wagner? That table, Mr. Cohen, do be careful.
You're not leaving us. I'm, yes, leaving. Leaving this waiver for him, for you, somebody to sign, and his birth certificate. Here is his card, if you will give it to me. If you will give him my card, Miss Bast, and urge him to get in touch with me, so I won't have to inconvenience you further.
Our counterfeit quarter, Julia. We wanted to show it to Mr. Cohen. It was such a crude job, Mr. Cohen, the copper showing right through at the edges, and one of our own tradesmen passed it on us. Can you see it there on the mantel?
I don't think he could see a thing, Anne, but it wasn't on the mantel this morning.
That one sticks, Mr. Cohen. You'd best use the side. It's the side that sticks, Julia. He'd better use the back. Out through the kitchen, Mr. Cohen.
And Mr. Cohen, once you're out there, if you'll just take a look in the back for the trees,
"'And he might listen, Julia,'
pursued him through the presence of potatoes and green beans with strings like packing thread, disintegrating with a smoked pork butt on the kitchen stove since near dawn, followed him as far as the corner of the house where a hanging gutter streaked clapboards and glass whenever it rained.
"'I don't think he's paid us any attention. Just see him out there. My, he is in a hurry!'
Avoiding an apple tree, its entire top blown out the year before, which redeemed itself now with a bumper crop of tasteless fruit in brave colors and curious shapes.
He looks like someone's chasing him.
He was certainly full of gossip for a perfect stranger.
I do wonder what James will have to say.
James will say what he's always said. He knows I've never believed it for one.
But even if you are right, Julia, if they weren't married till Edward was born, he's been Edward's father all these years.
You remember what Father used to say, the devil paying the piper for all the good tunes.
Yes, there he goes now.
The car crept up the drive, past trees which appeared to stagger without even provocation of a breeze, rearing their splintered amputations in all directions, an atmosphere of calamity tempered to the south by a brooding bank of oak, by several high locusts serenely distinct against the sky in the west.
It was naughty of James.
I hope he gets out through the hedge all right.
Did you hear that crash last night, and the sirens? It's a wonder they aren't all killed.
Listen!
To the squeal of brakes, the car burst out into the world trailing a festoon of privet, swerved at the immediate prospect of open acres flowered in funereal abundance to regain the pavement and lose it again in a brief threat to the candy wrappers and beer cans nestled along the hedge line up the highway, that quickly out of sight to the window's half-shaded stare from the roof pitches, frowning over the hedge to where it ended, and a yellow barn took up, and was gone in a swerving miss for the Pepperidge tree towering ahead, past shadeless windows in a naked farmhouse sprawl at the corner where the road trimmed neatly into the suburban labyrinth, and things came scaled down to wieldy size, dogwood, then firehouse, where once black crepe had been laboriously strung in such commemoration as that advertised today on the sign Our Dear Departed Member, easy to hang and store as a soft drink poster, past the crumbling eyesore dedicated within recent memory as the Marine Memorial, past the graveled vacancy of a parking lot, where a house, ravened by gingerbread, had held out till scarcely a week before, and through the center of town, where all allusion to permanence had disappeared or was being slain within earshot by shrieking electric saws, and the glint of chrome that streaked the glass bank front across the resident image of bank furniture, itself apparently designed to pick up and flee at a moment's notice, doors or no doors opened, as they were now, to dispense the soft music hovering aimlessly about a man pastelled to match the furniture, crowding the high-bosomed brunette at the curb with,
"'Something, Mrs. Joubert, something I'd meant to ask you, but, oh, wait a moment, there's Mr. Best, or Bast, is it? Mr. Bast, he's music appreciation, you know.'
"'He?'
"'What?' "'Oh, they're coming out? No, no, that's Vogel, Coach Vogel. You know him, the coach? Coach, good morning.'
"'Good what? Oh, Whiteback. Good morning. Didn't see you. I just robbed your bank.'
"'I didn't see you,' called Mr. Whiteback and waved. What did he do? The sun in my eyes.'
It caught him flat across the lenses, erasing any life behind them in a flash of inner vacancy, as he returned to,
"'Here, this young man coming here is Bast. You could probably tell he's in the arts, can't you? Mr. Bast, I was just telling Mrs. Joubert here, if she thinks she's pressed for space, you've had to rehearse all the way over to the Jewish temple since we had to take the cafeteria over for the driver training, right?' Mr. Bast is helping out Miss Flesh on her ring to have it ready for Friday. The Foundation is sending out a team to give our whole in-school television program the once-over, and giving them a look at Miss Flesh's ring will give a real boost to the cultural aspect of things. Not to slight your efforts, Mrs. Joubert. She has the new television course in, is it sixth grade social studies, Miss Joubert? What's in the paper bag? You haven't robbed the bank, Mrs. Joubert.
This? No, it's just money, she said, and shook the paper sack. Not mine, my class. It's what they've saved to buy a share in America. We're taking a field trip into the stock exchange to buy a share of stock. The boys and girls will follow its ups and downs and learn how our system works. That's why we call it our share.
In what?
In America, yes. Because actually owning it themselves, they'll feel...
No, I mean what stock?
That's our studio lesson today, deciding which one. If you want to look in on our channel, we have a resource film from the exchange itself, too.
Teaching our boys and girls what America is all about.
Stick 'em up!
Bast's elbow caught Mrs. Joubert a reeling blow in the breast. She dropped the sack of coins, and he stood for an instant poised with raised hand posed in pursuit of that injury before the flush that spread from her face to his sent him stooping to recover the sack by the top, spilling the coins from its burst bottom into the unmown strip of grass, and left him kneeling down where the wind moved her skirt.
Poor child! Why they let him run around loose!
It's the testing.
Mr. Whiteback withdrew a foot where his clocked ankle was nudged in pursuit of a dime, glancing down as it prospered to a quarter under Mrs. Joubert's expensively shod instep, and his voice was sheared off by an inhuman scream.
What was that? Oh, Mr. Bast, I'm sorry. I didn't hurt you.
She withdrew her heel from the back of his left hand as Bast got the nickel with his right, looking up from her flexed knee to start to speak.
"Those saws, they're doing the trees in the next block, widening Burgoyne Street," said Mr. Whiteback above. "I'll drop you if—Mr. Bast—"
He retired in the box step of the rumba, now spilling from the bank, out across the walk and into the grass, where Bast was going at it as though finding money lost by someone else.
If you can just pick the rest of it up and drop it off for Mrs. Joubert's studio lesson?
It was $24.
And still get to your rehearsal, Mr. Bast. To have it ready for Friday, we want to show this foundation team how we're motivating this cultural drive in our youngsters. It's all in preparation for the cultural festival next spring, you know, Miss Joubert. Watch his hand there, yes. To show we can make this cultural drive pay off like never before in mass consumers, mass distribution, mass publicity, just like automobiles and bathing suits.
And 63 cents, Mrs. Joubert finished, a gentle bulge rippling from her knee as she shifted her weight in departure to disappear in the swirl of her skirt. As the quarter bounding from the billowing trouser cuff drew Bast in a headlong lunge after the exhaust of Whiteback's car shearing from the curb, rounding the corner into Burgoyne Street to course through the shrieks of saws and limbs dangling in unanesthetized aerial surgery, turning at last into the faculty parking lot and into Gibbs's limited vista from a second-floor classroom window, watching Mrs. Joubert alight and come toward the portal beneath him. Knuckles gone white where he grasped the cold radiator, staring down into the loose fullness of her approach, till it was gone beneath the sill, and he turned back to the darkened classroom, to face the talking face in flattened animation on the screen itself, until the tension of watching without listening broke the surface in a slight twitch of his own lip, and turned him back to the window, looking down. Now into the wide eye of a camera aimed up at himself and the frieze of teachers similarly abandoned in windows surmounting the dedication of the school hewn over the entrance.
Epsilon Beta Phi Mu Sigma Alpha Omicron Eta Alpha Theta Theta Beta Rho.
Oh, can you read it?
Asked the young man with the camera, lowering it to join the congregation of cameras, meters, and accessories strung from what convenient protrusions his lank figure afforded.
"'Not exactly read it,' said his companion, a scrap of paper spread on the back of a heavy book in the crook of his arm. "'But I thought I'd copy it down. It might make a good epigraph for the book when I find out what it means. And get some of those blank faces. There, the one at that window having a smoke in the boys' washroom while his class is being taught by television. Speaking of technological unemployment.'
I don't think that's the point the Foundation wants you to stress particularly, but it's your book.
But you're paying for it.
The camera snapped and joined the others, swinging to their stride as they passed in beneath the sill and out of the view of Mr. Gibbs, molested from behind by words.
Energy may be changed, but not destroyed.
From a basement door, Mr. Leroy rose into the sunlight bearing a pail, and his smile, intimate even at the distance, turned directly up to Gibbs before there was chance to evade it, as he glided over the gravel in the silence of the boxing shoes laced tightly to the image of nonviolence, his passage insisted everywhere he went.
Scientists believe that the total amount of energy in the world today is the same as it was at the beginning of time.
Turn that off.
But wait, Mr. Gibbs, it's not over. That's our studio lesson we'll be tested on.
All right. Let's have order here. Order.
He'd reached the set himself and snapped it into darkness.
Put on the lights there now. Before we go any further here, has it ever occurred to any of you that all this is simply one grand misunderstanding? Since you're not here to learn anything but to be taught so you can pass these tests, knowledge has to be organized so it can be taught, and it has to be reduced to information so it can be organized. Do you follow that? In other words, this leads you to assume that organization is an inherent property of the knowledge itself, and that disorder and chaos are simply irrelevant forces that threaten it from outside. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Order is simply a thin, perilous condition we try to impose on the basic reality of chaos.
But we didn't have any of this, you...
That's why you're having it now, just once, if you could, if somebody in this class could stop fighting off the idea of trying to think. All right. It all comes back to this question of energy, doesn't it? A concept that can't be understood without a grasp of the second law of, yes? Can't you hear me in the back there?
This wasn't in the reading assignment, and that...
And that, he paused to align pencils on his desk, all pointing in the same direction, before he looked up to her, far in the back, bunched high and girlish by a princess waist, bangs shading the face, pancaked into concert with her classmates in the shadowless vacancy of youth. That is why I am telling it to you now. Now, the concept we were discussing yesterday. First, a definition.
The tendency of a body which, when it is at rest, to...
Never mind. Next.
And which, when it is in motion, to re...
I said never mind. No one? Does anyone dare try to spell it, then?
He turned, reaching...
Okay. Yeah, right, wow. Buddy. That's it for tonight.
Cool it.
Sorry to cut you off there, Nick, but my feeling is that you were going to go forever.
That's right. You were, I saw you warming up for a big long one there, buddy. So we're on to you, Chief. We can see what you're doing.
Yeah. I'm afraid we didn't get clearance with Solomon or Mr. Jungle Guts to go all night this time. There was that one time with Phil Elverum where we went all night, but I think they only let him do that because he's kind of like an indie rock sensation, but not tonight.
Yeah, we don't do that every night, dude. We don't do that every night. Okay? Don't make that face. Stop making that face. It's not going to help.
No need to get angry. It's okay, Nick. All right. You don't got to make those faces and those voices.
Back away from the microphone, Nick. Cool it. Okay, just calm down.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the content of Nick's talk, the William Gaddis writing, I'm reminded of a John Mouse lyric that goes something like this.
What you gonna do with all that money? What you gonna do? What you gonna do? What you gonna do with all that money?
You know that lyric, Steve? You remember that one?
Oh, I do. I'm actually a really big John Mouse fan. So, actually, hold on. I've got it right here on my phone. Let's just turn that on, and we'll listen to that while we keep going, okay? We'll enjoy that a bit. Let me just, I'm just gonna cut to the part, it's got the part in it here, okay? Hold on. Here we go. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? What you gonna do with all of that money? Yeah. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? What you gonna do with all of that money? So keep it to yourself, keep it to yourself, keep it to yourself. Put it in the pot so you feel like John Lennon. Hey! See much money, love, see much money. Just, turning it down a bit there, I think, might be a good idea. Anyway, it's something we don't do a lot of here on the talking show, listening to records and all that. You okay with this happening, Nick? Can you handle this? It's okay with you? Oh, you're bobbing your head. You're enjoying yourself. Hey, come back to
Steve,
the mic.
Steve, what would you do with all that money?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. You know, go on a trip somewhere, maybe. Build myself a nice house. Saltwater pool. I don't know.
Okay, well, there's something to think about as you lay your tired head to sleep tonight. Good night from the Talking Show here on K-Chung Radio.
Good night, everyone.